Where will you find the first green residential high-rise in the country? Right here in New York. And where will you find architects and builders designing skyscrapers that use the least amount of energy and renewable energy at that? Again, right here in New York City. This is all part of the drive to shape what this city will look like in the future and what it will be like to live here. New York is more than a concrete jungle. It's a city situated on the sea, and surrounded by water, it's especially captive to the consequences of climate change. Scientists say that rising global temperatures over the next 50 to 100 years could raise sea levels by 3 feet or more. What kind of threat does that pose to the heart of this city's transportation system, the underground subways, or to its water supply? Decades more of climate change will bring hotter summers with more demand for electricity and the higher levels of air pollution due to air conditioning demand. Will the heat threaten not only New York's utilities, but also the health of the 20 million people who live and work in the metropolitan area? Scientists here in New York have tackled those questions, taking global climate predictions and bringing them down to the local level, trying to forecast what a hot summer day nearly 50 years from now will be like. It's been called climate science with a Zoom lens. We're broadcasting today from the City University of New York's Graduate Center in Midtown Manhattan, and we'll be discussing climate change and New York in the year 2050. We're going to also talk about green design, and that's where creating buildings that are friendlier to the environment can actually mitigate global warming. How do you do that? Well, we'll talk about green roofs. That means growing plants and grasses and things on your roof, and an office tower that's going to go up just a few blocks from here, a few blocks north of here. It will be the greenest skyscraper in the United States. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the auditorium at the City University, please step up to the microphones, and we're very happy to take questions from you. Let me introduce my guests. Cynthia Rosenzweig is a research scientist at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and a research scientist in the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia University in New York. Welcome to the program. Patrick Kinney is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences in the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Joyce Rosenthal is an adjunct assistant professor of urban planning in the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and the project manager for the New York Climate and Health Project in the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Rick Cook is a partner at Cook Plus Fox Architects New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick.
Well, let me start with you, Cynthia. Your climate model, zooms into New York City in the year 2050. What will a day like New York, let's say, you know, give us a typical day in New York City be like then?
Well, first of all, we never just use one model, Ira. We always use a range. Mm-hmm. It's important because of the uncertainties involved in the global warming issue. So I'm going to give you a range. On an annual basis, the temperature in the 2050s will be 3 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the weather we have now.
Hmm. Will it be raining more? Can we expect more precipitation?
Well, the precipitation story is complicated. Some models say more precipitation, some models say less. But what they all agree on is an intensification of the hydrological cycle. So the answer is we'll be having more droughts and more floods.
So the extremes.
More climate extremes.
And what about big storms like hurricanes? Would they be more intense if we get them and those sorts of things too?
The science is still out on whether we're going to get more hurricanes or fewer. Mm-hmm. But what we do know, because of the sea level rise, that for the same level of storm, we're going to get more damage in New York City.
From the storm surge.
From the storm surges. That's the real vulnerability of New York to the sea level rise.
So much is underground here.
So much is either at sea level or very, very close to sea level. So not only are very expensive real estate like Lower Manhattan, but also the places where folks live, Coney Island, the Far Rockaways, and our ecosystems too are at risk. For example, Jamaica Bay, right out by JFK Airport, is already showing signs of loss in a very complicated environmental situation, mm-hmm. but where our projections show potential damage to our ecosystems as well. So it's across the board vulnerability.
Does that mean that low-lying areas, even like the subways, might be flooded more if we get a storm coming through?
Oh, very much so. In our regional assessment of global warming for New York, we worked with the Port Authority, our FEMA Region 2, and our EPA, and we looked at the critical elevations for those transportation facilities, like the subways, the Holland Tunnels, the airports are all built are at very low elevations. So we are beginning to identify the types of infrastructures that we need to work on to prepare to be ready.
You mean what, to put up seawalls or dikes or things like that, like Holland, you know, Netherlands has?
We are going to have to decide as a region what we want to protect, what we may be able to pull back from. We're just now, as a consequence, I think, of the report and lots of the studies on broader studies on global warming, really bringing this global issue down to the regional level. How can we prepare? How can we adapt? And how can we mitigate the problem?
We'll get into that a little bit later. Patrick Kinney, let's talk about the health effects of climate change. What does a warming mean for the residents of 30 million people in the neighboring, you know, New York City area?
Well, the most direct impact is, of course, heat stress. And that's already a problem in large cities like New York. More people die on hot days in the summertime than on other days. The people that are most vulnerable tend to be the elderly, the young, and the sick. We expect, based on our modeling, that will be increased, obviously, in the 2050s because simply the number of extreme days will be much higher.
And you share that with other cities. Look what happened in Chicago a few years ago, right?
That's a good example of the vulnerability of large cities. That's a direct effect. There's many other less direct effects that we worry about and that we're also looking at. One is impacts on air quality, as you mentioned. As well as changes in the ecology of organisms that deliver diseases like mosquitoes, malaria-carrying mosquitoes and the like, which in warmer, moister temperatures can survive better. So we're also interested in those kinds of health impacts. They're much harder to predict, however.
Do you think we're seeing some of these diseases we haven't seen ever, except in the Middle East, which are, you know, coming over by mosquitoes?
Yes, I think so. It's very hard to really pin down the exact reasons for those emergences, but it seems that the changing climate certainly plays a role in that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, more you mentioned air pollution. That means more illnesses, asthma, things like that.
Exactly. Both ozone and fine particles, these tiny particles that float in the air and that can penetrate into our lungs, are likely to be enhanced at higher temperatures, partly because of the increased power generation to deal with the high temperatures, but also at higher temperatures, the chemical reactions in the atmosphere that form those pollutants are also heightened. So mm-hmm. there's a couple of different reasons why it might increase.
What this tells me that both you and Cynthia are saying is that as a city planner, when a city plans about things, if there's only a finite amount of money for, you know, and cities are always worrying about their budgets and deficits and things, that just trying to keep up with the climate change is going to suck a lot of money out of just keeping the institutions running, things that we wouldn't have to worry about, flooding subways and Cynthia?
Well, what we learned from our report, though, is that it's much better to address these issues earlier rather than later. It's far more expensive if you wait for those big mm-hmm. storms to hit.
All right, we're going to get. Let's get to the Joyce Rosenthal. Tell us about the heat island. We always knew that New York City, it's a lot of concrete and whatever, it keeps the heat in, right?
Right.
How much does that affect the climate around
Well,
here?
In addition to the global climate change that Cynthia spoke of, there's also a phenomenon of cities have a great impact due to urbanization and urban land uses on their regional and local climate and on atmospheric processes. And basically, the urban heat island is that increase by definition mm-hmm. of temperature in the city center relative to surrounding rural areas. So that phenomena has been studied in many cities, and cities like New York City can be anywhere from 2 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit higher than the surrounding regions. And that, of course, leads to a whole host of adverse air quality impacts and health impacts.
All you have to do is look from an airplane or whatever and look down on the flat blacktop roofs that you see, you know, the tar beaches, as they call them here in New York. It just would seem like a no-brainer that if at least paint them white or something, Joyce, that we could at least mitigate that. But there are even more creative ways. People are planting gardens.
That's right. There's a strong constituency in New York City that would like to see the development of a truly ecological infrastructure and building built environment in New York City. And actually, there's three main strategies for urban heat island mitigation, all that have synergistic and positive environmental impacts. Increased street trees and, as you mentioned, green roofs, reflective surfaces, permeable pavements that might increase evaporation and cooling by evaporation, and, of course, just lighter roofs as they use in California. There's really demonstrated energy savings from all these type of strategies.
And Rick Cook, you're an architect who is helping to design new skyscrapers, especially a new one here in One Bryant Park. Tell us about some of the green features of this building.
Well, as Joyce mentioned, green roofs are economic. They make sense. They save this local heat island. But more than that, they're beautiful. And being visual people, I think that's a way to really effectuate change also. I'm a kid of the 60s, and I remember the saying, think globally, act locally. Mm-hmm. And we've been blessed with an opportunity to work at scale at One Bryant Park. And there are things that happen there that I was even slightly cynical about. We look at being wise stewards of our resources. And one of the things we talked about is water as a resource that's really very precious. I was kind of cynical about something called a waterless urinal. But at scale in this building, just changing from conventional urinals to waterless urinals will save 3 million gallons of drinking water every single year. People tell me that's 12 seconds of Niagara Falls water. Wow. It's just a phenomenal amount of water, and being able to work at scale is just a remarkable opportunity. And we have a great client who's very committed to it's the Durst Organization.
And they've been out in the forefront of green buildings around the city, right?
They have. There's other things about CO2, this greenhouse effect. Some of these things don't really cost money. We're using concrete slabs and walls that'll use 45% blast furnace slag. And what does that mean, really? It's recycled content. That alone is a reduction in millions of tons of CO2 production for a building like this.
And what about innovative ways of heating or cooling the building?
Sure. There are many different uses for how we get this energy into the building, how we use it intelligently. One of the things we're doing is called ice storage. So you make ice at night when the infrastructure is not stressed out, and you use it to cool the building at the peak time in the middle of the summer. It just makes sense. All of a sudden we think, like, why aren't we doing this all the time?
Right.
And the Durst Organization has done that very successfully on another one of the projects that they have.
What about geothermal? Is that in your arsenal of weapons?
Well, we're doing another project, 14 buildings in Lower Manhattan and South Street Seaport, right on the waterfront, right where Melville sent Ishmael off to seek the whale, very much affected by rises in sea level. Down there, we're using something called geothermal wells, which rely on the heat sink capacity of the earth to provide all the heating and cooling for all 14 buildings, 3 new buildings and 11 restored buildings, which, by the way, is inherently green. Historic mm-hmm. preservation is a form of recycling.
Any use of wind power in any of these designs?
Right. We're very excited about not only our project, Harvesting Wind, but even the proposed Freedom Tower. The very first view of Manhattan was 1626. There's a view of Manhattan. The tallest thing in the skyline was a windmill.
Is that right?
It was tall.
Well, the Dutch were here first.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And not only that, what power source did they use to get here? They used wind. So our project is proposing a wind turbine at the top of the building to generate power. Part of that is it really does make power. It also creates some kind of educational component. What makes this building different? What moves us? What does it say about the kinds of buildings we make? Do we care about these things?
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with our guests about the future of New York City. Talk about the health problems, what to expect about the climate change. Take your calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the future of New York City. What will climate change bring for this city and how we might abate or mitigate some of the worst parts of that with our guest Cynthia Rosenzweig, who is at Columbia University, Patrick McKinney at the Mailman School of Columbia, Joyce Rosenthal from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia, and Rick Cook of Cook Plus Fox Architects in New York. Our number 1-800-989-8255. I want to finish with Rick talking about these green buildings. They're quite interesting. Tell us about improving the air quality. How do you deal with the air quality of the buildings itself, and what will your building do to improve air quality around New York City or buildings like yours?
Well, I think the most important thing about these buildings is it's not too late to change the scenario that's already been outlined. It is possible for these buildings to be living machines to clean the air, not to make it dirtier. The building that we're proposing, it will filter out 95% of the dust and pollen coming into the indoor environment, making it a healthier indoor environment. But not only that, the air exiting the building will be cleaner than when it came in. It's a giant machine for cleaning air as opposed to something that pollutes the air.
I mean, other people around the city, do they take notice of this? I mean, can you show them how they can save money by building green buildings like this?
Absolutely. The Battery Park City Authority has actually instituted green building guidelines, and they're showing people that these buildings make sense. The first one was completed, called the Solaire, the first green high-rise, and these things are very real. We're learning more and more about the payback periods, but one thing we know for sure is there is improved health, there's a dramatic reduction in energy expenditures, and over life cycling, it doesn't make any sense to do anything but a building like this.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia, let's talk a bit about green roofs. He's talking about green skyscrapers. I have, a high rise, not a high rise, I have a four-floor walk-up or some sort of roof, any apartment buildings in Manhattan. Can we really make an impact by growing these gardens on them and saving energy?
Well, Ira, this is an active research area. We are very much trying to do research to come up with the exact answer of that. Mm-hmm. But we use some data and models to make projections. One of the things we look at is satellite images of the city to see where the hot neighborhoods are. We're just seeing that Long Island City, the airports, South Bronx, Red Hook, some of the most,
right.
the areas that really do have very strong urban heat islands there. So we'd have to do it on a neighborhood basis.
So you can set up like a test neighborhood. One house is green, has the green stuff growing on the roof, and one doesn't next to it.
We're doing that with models, and then there are also just beginning to be funded some projects around the city. One in Queens that we hope funded by NYSERDA, the New York mm-hmm. State Energy Research and Development Agency, to actually put some instruments. But given all that this is an active research area, for the urban heat island effect, we think that about 10%, that's our hypothesis, 10% of the buildings in such a neighborhood would need to be greened to actually begin to cool the neighborhood. Mm. But just think about walking in Central Park, how much cooler it is there than in the Midtown neighborhoods right next door.
Do you actually grow plant? I mean, what do you cover with soil and put plants there? And it's a little garden, so to speak, Joyce?
They're actually highly evolved engineered systems for existing rooftops that really are site specific, but they're comprised of many layers, including vegetation at the top, then a soil or a growing medium, and then several layers of fabric filters, root barriers, water retention layers, and waterproofing membranes, so that actually most buildings can hold some sort of, small amount of green mm-hmm. roof on them, but there are buildings that need structural engineers right. to assess if they can hold the additional weight that would be represented by a green roof.
And these hotspot neighborhoods that you're talking about, some of them are located right under the major bridges in New York, and so if these were built, they would be their own selling points, right? Yeah. You drive over the bridge, hey, look, and there's another one, maybe I should have one.
The first site is right near the 59th Street Bridge. You can see it as you exit that, as you come across that in Queens. And yes, very much. As Rick was saying, it's the aesthetic value is tremendous as well. So it's very exciting, I think.
And as Cynthia was pointing out, certain neighborhoods are warmer than others because studies of the urban fabric of cities has shown that non-residential areas, commercial areas, industrial areas tend to have more pavement and fewer mm-hmm. trees in residential areas. So those areas, like Hunts Point or Long Island City, may be warmer than other residential neighborhoods.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Dave in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Say, my question was, I'm all for this. I think it's a great idea. Is there any, and I've looked into solar and geothermal for my own home, but I went with the typical, gas when I, invested in a new furnace. Is there any hardcore legislation for homeowners to invest in this for by, say, federal tax incentives or tax breaks?
I mean, like Jimmy Carter gave when he was said that
yeah,
conservation was equivalent to war.
Exactly. Well,
the president used one word in the State of the Union. He said conservation once, I think. That was it. Joyce?
Well, I know the state of California used to provide rebates and tax incentives for cool roofing strategies, but I want to refer your listeners also to a very good new website, www.greeningotham.org, that contains a lot of information about green roofs and policy issues like this as well.
All right, Dave, thanks for calling. And obviously, Rick, you don't need any incentives. Do you realize the benefits already?
We do, but in fact, NYSERDA, New York State,
right.
Is providing a supplement of $800 per ton for the geothermal. They are more expensive to build than a conventional system, but there are programs in place now to help people afford the new technologies, even though they gain the benefits over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. And you said the tower that's going up to replace the World Trade Center is going to have a wind turbine on top of it.
The proposal, which was released, also had proposed wind turbines at the top, which is extremely exciting.
It's certainly a selling point for it.
It is. And the trick here is that these things say something about the kind of buildings we believe in. Buildings say something about who we are and what our aspirations are. Mm-hmm. The new transit hub was just revealed, this incredibly beautiful building by Santiago Calatrava, all talking about the environment, how there's natural light, how it'll be a fundamentally different kind of place. And I think as we make buildings that say something about our goals and aspirations, it helps educate the public.
How green can a building be? How green can you get all the way? If you had blank check, or you're there with this new building in One Bryant.
Well, it's interesting. I think it's a process. We're striving very hard to help change the marketplace. Probably the greenest thing is probably not to build. The second thing, don't consume. And Americans consume a completely disproportionate amount of energy compared to other cultures. The second one is reuse, recycle, historic preservation. And then if you're going to build on an already disturbed site over mass transit. So One Bryant Park, the remarkable thing about that is we're going to house 8,000 people on 2 acres of land over the top of transit hubs, as opposed to a suburban development that might take hundreds of acres. We are striving every single year. We get more and more products that are commercially available. So the point is, we're working very hard. We're only partway there yet.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia?
I'd like to speak particularly in terms of the response to the global warming issue. It's very exciting for me and the scientists we work with, who've been working now on the issue for about 2 decades, that solutions to the global warming are beginning to be actually created. And it's
give us an idea.
Two different,
for example.
Yeah, sure. Well, I want to say on these green buildings for New York, what's so great is that it deals with the global warming issue in 2 ways. One is the reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions, which is the actual mitigation of those warming. Those projections are without any green buildings and other actions, mm-hmm. in terms of fuel efficiency, for example, that will bring down those eventual warmings. So the green buildings help on address the cause of the warming. But the second important thing that they do is that they help adapt to the eventual warming, because we are going to have some warming because of the gases that we've already put in. And having the buildings which help cool the people inside is an adaptation to warming. So these buildings work on both ways, on both parts, responses to the global warming issue. And it's just really great for scientists, just speaking for myself, to be working in terms of science for solutions, mm-hmm. instead of always bringing forward the problems.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joyce.
And I'd like to take your question on a regional scale also. Mm-hmm. We need green buildings and green, compact, well-designed cities, because in the last 50 years, the pace of land consumption has far outpaced population growth in our area, leading to what's popularly known as suburban sprawl, which is really manifested in every metropolitan region almost in the country. But in our region, the growth in land uses, urbanized land uses, has increased over fourfold more than population growth. So we really need to develop strategies that make cities livable, habitable, cooler, and just more sustainable, so that we don't use up all the remaining forest land and agricultural land.
Let me go to the audience here at the microphone. Yes, sir.
Hi, Ira. My name is Shiloh. first time I've actually spoken to you in person, not on the phone. if I can, two quick things. The first is for Mr. Cook. The geotherm system I'm a little familiar with because we use them in some of the properties on the east end of Long Island. What type of sear to what type of max tonnage are you guys getting from your systems?
We have to speak in non-jargon terms.
SEER is your seasonal energy efficiency rating.
Okay. Now, Rick, translate that for us.
Okay, Shiloh. The idea of geothermal, which we've also used out in East Hampton at a building called the Ross Institute Center for Wellbeing, uses groundwater. You take water from the ground that's at a temperature of about 54 degrees and run it past a heat plate exchanger to take heat out or put heat back in. And the rest of the technology is heat pump technology, and it has the efficiencies of whatever heat pumps have in current marketplace. In the South Street Seaport, what we're doing is actually drilling holes into the Manhattan Schist, about 1,500 feet deep. And what we're getting, we did the first one, we did the test, we're getting about 30 to 40 tons of capacity out of each well. Very high performing because of some of the water infiltration from the Manhattan Schist. We've tested it, it's performing, it's great. It means that we have 10 geothermal wells cooling an entire neighborhood there. It means that no silver rooftop mechanical equipment all being heated. Hmm. Was that an adequate response to your question, Travis?
Yes, it was.
Does that mean that the water is cold down there or hotter down there?
Well, the Earth, at depths that we're talking about, tries to maintain a temperature of about 54 degrees. So if we put 80-degree water in, it will tend to cool it back down. And if we put cold water in, it will tend to warm it back up. It has that ability to heat sink. It's the surface area of the rock actually is a giant heat transfer mechanism, and it costs us nothing.
So it's just the cost of drilling the hole and pumping the water up and down.
Exactly.
Wow. It sounds pretty cheap.
Wow was good.
Well, a lot of installers of air conditionings may not want to hear that in this city. It's so easy to do that. I mean, is that a tough sell sometimes? Are there vested interests in not going green for some of those reasons?
Only the motion of how we typically do things. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of this green movement is about just starting and thinking differently from day one. What are you trying to accomplish? And really, we still use conventional technologies once we get past that source of heat rejection or heat gathering. So there's mm-hmm. still a lot of work for everyone. Aaron.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Paris in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Paris.
Hello there.
Hi there.
I guess I might be on a little different tack. I own a window covering company in Portland, and we've just shifted our entire focus in what we're trying to do over to shading systems, you know, green building and energy conservation by pushing shading systems that help, you know, reduce the heat exchange in buildings, making them more energy efficient. It's something that we can do even with older homes, you know, by improving how, you know, heat loss through windows and that sort of thing. And we're pretty excited about green builds coming in Portland in November. And I was just wondering if any of your guests had any comments about the value and the increasing attention being given to improved window shading systems and their benefit to the whole green building process.
Right, Paris, we'll get an answer. Rick, are these glass towers that you're building, or do they have shades in them? How does that
yes.
work?
Well, the issue with shading is once you shade on the inside of glass, you make the occupant more comfortable, but you've allowed the heat energy inside. So the idea is to reflect heat energy from the outside. So at One Bryant Park, the south-facing portion of the building will have what's called a double wall technology, a deep double wall. And we're actually going to shade in that void so that we break up the sun's light before it hits the occupant. They have floor-to-ceiling glass so they have the view out, and we reject the heat energy in that void before it gets inside. So shading is a hugely important component. The trick is, where do you do it, on the outside of the building or on the inside?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cynthia, when you make your models of cities of the future, let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Get done with the business part. You go to the mayor and you talk to him and say, look, this is looks like the future of New York City. If you don't take steps X, Y, and Z, are city officials or city planners, do they listen or they say, well, you know, this is politics, not the climate here?
Let me tell you how we did our regional assessment. A little bit differently than the past 20 years in which scientists, I think, were trying to do just the way you mm-hmm. just said. But what we did was we made research teams in different sectors, the sea level rise, wetlands, public health, water supply. And for each one of those teams, we brought in partners on the teams from the city agencies. And so we worked together from the very beginning mm-hmm. to see what are the questions that those folks need to know what we share data and models, like, for example, the beach erosion model from the Army Corps of Engineers to keep Coney Island being a beach. That's one example. And then at the end, what did our study mean? And we drew those conclusions together. That's the way we have to go, working together. And then the agency, the decision makers, folks, we call them stakeholders, they then take the information back, but they own it in a very different way to then go to some of those hard political issues. But we feel that this is a better process.
You bring them in early, so it's part their idea. They
exactly.
don't have to sell it to them.
Exactly. And so we're working now to develop an ongoing consortium among the agencies to then take this on in our city in appropriate and realistic ways, not in any kind of gloom and doom way, but in realistic ways. What do we need to do now? What can we put off?
Patrick, can you say the same thing in planning other things?
Well, yeah. For example, the Department of Health is particularly interested in projecting impacts of bad air quality days in the summertime and extreme heat events. And we've been working, starting with the Metro East Coast project that Cynthia led, we've been working with the people at Department of Health to integrate our modeling methods into their systems for predicting and also for adapting and preventing these kinds of impacts from occurring in the summertime. And we're trying to do more and more of that.
Mm-hmm. So, quick, Joyce, before the break.
And what's been unique, I think, about the New York Climate and Health Project is that it's one of the first time a real place-based downscaled modeling system that projects impacts at the urban scale of 4 to 12 kilometers has really been able to take the global climate model projections, which are made at a continental scale of hundreds of kilometers, to look zooming down on local neighborhoods and looking at vulnerable populations so we can better assess health impacts.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll take a short break. We come back. We're going to talk lots more about the future of New York City, health-wise, climate-wise, building-wise, and any other wise you'd like to add to the pot. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climate change impacts and mitigation strategies for New York City with my guests Cynthia Rosenzweig, Patrick Kinney, Joyce Rosenthal, and Rick Cook. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience here for a question.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Wells. This is a question for Dr. Rosenzweig. Dr. Rosenzweig, I've read that a paradoxical result of global warming is that the Gulf Stream could change course and actually turn south faster at a lower latitude than it is now, and that this could make New York in the Northern Hemisphere more vulnerable to Arctic storms. I see you nodding, so could you comment on that?
There are some outlier scenarios that atmospheric scientists and oceanographers look at that have very low probability but then have potentially very large effects. And the scenario of the shift in the Gulf Stream is exactly that you bring forward is exactly one of those low probability but huge large impacts. We study those, colleagues are studying those, and we take them into account in what if or surprise. We call those potential surprise scenarios. The projections that I've been giving are for the somewhat higher probability range of possible futures.
So what are the ingredients in that? Those predictions, what do you throw into the pot?
In the ones that we use, the assumptions are what else is going to be happening. In order to know how the climate will change in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, you have to project how the population will grow, how the economic growth will play out in different regions of the world, how the energy technologies may change. And we look at a set of possible futures of those factors, and then how those factors may then affect the greenhouse gas emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, but other ones, methane, nitrous oxides as well.
So then the city planners who are with you at the beginning of this process, do they then say, oh, well, if we if we do some green building here, we might mitigate this, but we'll trade off that for this.
And that's really the idea. So that the framework that we're working with now in the New York Climate and Health Project is really to look at two possible futures for the region. One is a kind of business as usual with large amounts of warming. Another one is with using elements of smart growth, as Rick and Joyce have been talking about here today. And so, in a sense, we're creating a framework and tools for our city planners to think about making those decisions for the future. What choices are we going to make for our region? Mm-hmm. But we have to keep in mind that there may be surprises, as Gary brought up.
What kind of surprise would
wouldn't
that
be a surprise if you knew it?
Oh, that would be abrupt cooling and with more Arctic storms. So would be very, very
like
severe
winter,
scenario for here.
Kind of winters we've been having the last 2 years. Rick, does that go for you, Patrick? Go for you also when you present this scenario? What do you throw into your health look at the city? What's the range of possibilities?
Well, what we do is we take the climate outputs from the models that Cynthia runs at GIS, and then we add in a few other elements. Mm-hmm. In particular, more projections about population, how they're going to grow, where they're going to be, and then we try to interlay the geography of the temperature changes over the geography mm-hmm. of the population changes, mm-hmm. and then sometimes what we see is some interaction. That is, where the worst heating will occur is also where the most vulnerable people are. So we really try to bring in the human element when we're looking at the health impacts.
But if we were to stop greenhouse gases this moment, there's enough in the atmosphere to continue on with a bit of global warming. What do you say to people now? I mean, is Fire Island doomed for rising? What do you tell the planners of, you know, is part of Coney Island going to go under no matter what we do? And how does a city deal with that? Tell the developers don't build houses there anymore? To tell the insurance people don't insure those houses? How do you get to the real nitty-gritty of this stuff versus, you know, well, what might happen down in the future? Joyce?
Well, you know, if adaptation is harm reduction, for current problems like summertime extreme heat days, and mitigation is primary prevention of future greenhouse gas warming, then we really have to use very common sense, you know, strategies now, like the cool roofs and the green roofs, like new types of reflective pavements and street trees that make sense economically on a short scale and also mitigate future harm as well. So they can help us today and in the future.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Andrew, San Francisco, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I have a quick question. My family is doing a 190-unit development in Hawaii, and we would like to implement a lot of these green ideologies. And we're wondering if, in fact, there's a clearinghouse that we could go to and find more information. And the question is twofold. How do we ID, identify an architect and or a consultant, and at what stage would you bring someone in to do this?
Rick, any advice?
Sure. There's in the United States, the U.S. Green Building Council has done great work, and their website is usgbc.org. And I would recommend going there. You would have several other links to other organizations that could provide data. My strongest recommendation for you and your family, Andrew, is start thinking about it now and work with somebody who's completely committed to the goal of thinking it out in an integrated approach, not what would you do conventionally and what do we spend to do a couple things differently, but really think about it from the beginning. Some things like solar orientation don't cost anything if you're just thinking about it in the beginning. But I recommend USGBC as a great source for information.
That's okay.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you're welcome.
Thanks for calling, Andrew. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to this gentleman over here by the...
My name is Fred. What are the regulatory mechanisms by which the Earth maintains its thermal equilibrium? For example, radiation of incident heat. And how will those mechanisms, how is it projected that those mechanisms will be affected by temperature increases?
Cynthia, do you factor those?
Oh, absolutely. The Earth has in our atmosphere a natural greenhouse effect. We are surrounded in our atmosphere by gases that absorb the long-wave radiation that re-radiates the sun's radiation to our planet. And water vapor is the number one greenhouse gas, but then beyond that, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide hold the heat. They serve to hold the heat. It's almost a kind of a atmospheric blanket around our planet. If we didn't have those, our planet would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than it already is, and we wouldn't be here. What we are doing in the greenhouse global warming issue, and why has it come forward in such a strong way for the past 20 years, is that by our burning of fossil fuels and also cutting down our forests primarily for agriculture, we are releasing excess amounts, additional amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that will hold more heat around our planet. That's the mechanism of our natural greenhouse effect and our enhanced greenhouse effect, which is projected to cause global warming. And because we're already warming, not globally, and also we see in New York, is very likely already causing warming today.
How do you deal with global warming as a political issue? There are people, because of their beliefs of politics or whatever, do not believe that we are in a global warming period, that, or if we are a human-induced global warming.
I believe, as scientists, we're trained to be straight shooters, and we put forward our best understanding at any time. The models are in development constantly, so they don't have all the answers yet. But as scientists, we have the responsibility to bring forward what our results are, with the caveats, with the uncertainties, but to bring forward the significance of this major change in our energy, in our planetary energy balance.
Talking about the future of New York in the year 2050, this hour, and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Rick, there seems to be a lot of interest in One Bryant Park. Give us an idea of the kinds of energy savings, how much water, how much CO2, things like that that building will save.
Sure. The energy savings are projected to be up to 50% of normal energy savings, and that's great. And it's a 2 million square foot building. A building like this conventionally uses about $3 per square foot in energy use. So if you save half of it, it's $1.50 times 2 million, $3 million a year. That's all great. But the real issues are actually health, productivity, indoor environment. So the real numbers are, in one sick day in America is worth $27 billion. So if you can make a healthier environment, that's really where the answers are.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to save all of the stormwater on the building and reuse it. So dramatic reduction in water usage, 3 million gallons a year just in the waterless urinals. In general, just a half of the energy consumption that a normal building like this would consume.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two before we have to go. Mike in Cleveland. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, go ahead.
Pleasure to speak to you all. I had a question for Mr. Cook, whether or not they're going to incorporate vertical axis wind turbines or any type of wind turbines into One Bryant Park, and whether or not photovoltaic solar panels will be incorporated in the building skin.
Yes to both your questions. The issue with the vertical axis wind turbines is
that's a turbine that spins
exactly. If you picture
horizontally,
a Dutch windmill,
yeah.
That's horizontal axis. It's
right.
A big prop fan that spins around. And the great thing about those is that they use lift, just like an airplane wing, and they're very efficient. Visually, being architects, we like the looks of the vertical axis, and the technology isn't quite up to speed yet. We're looking at several vertical axis wind turbines right now, which aren't quite as efficient as the horizontal. But the great thing is it doesn't have to go in for several years, and the marketplace is changing continually. On photovoltaics, they've also become much more efficient, and the project will incorporate photovoltaics. The shape of the building is also kind of optimized for solar gain on the southwest, and we're going to have photovoltaics at the top of the building. My partner, Bob Fox, was involved in the project immediately next door called Four Times Square, the Condé Nast building, and that incorporated building-integrated photovoltaics. We learned a lot there, and we intend to do it at One Bryant Park. One other thought, Ira, for Andrew was the Battery Park City Green Design Guidelines is a very interesting clearinghouse also, authored by Bob Fox. And if you went to Battery Park City Authority, you could see the kind of they have specific data on how much you could save and what the normal marketplace technologies are.
One last question. I think we have time. Patrick Kinney, what's next for the New York Climate and Health Project?
Well, we're going to we've looked very carefully at the 2050s, and what we'd like to do is bring the projections of health impacts of climate change into the more immediate future. So we're beginning to do a lot of simulations focusing on the about 20 years off into the future. And the other thing is we're starting to use models that can go to a much finer geographic scale so that we can really understand the impacts in particular communities as opposed to other communities. That's really where we're headed with it.
Well, we've run out of time. I would like to thank all of you for joining us. Cynthia Rosenzweig, research scientist at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and research scientist in the Center for Climate Systems at Columbia University. Patrick Kinney, associate professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences in the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. Also, Joyce Rosenthal, adjunct assistant professor of urban planning at the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and project manager for the New York Climate and Health Project at the Mailman School of Public Health, and Rick Cook, partner at Cook Plus Fox Architects in New York. Thank you for taking time
Thank
to be with
Ira.
Us today.
Thank you,
our technical director is Kevin Waite, and we had help from audio engineers Neil Rausch here in New York and Vince Muse and Neil Tivault in Washington. We also had help from Chad Campbell, Susan Lund, and Brendan Barnazak in Washington. Also here, thank you to Foster Henry, Aaron Zatchko, Peter Harris, John Chinesi, Adrian Klein here at the Graduate Center in New York. Thank you all for helping us out to get the program on the air today. If you'd like to write, surf over to sciencefriday.com. We've got all the links you might have missed today. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. We make free curricula for teachers. You can download them from our website. You can also listen to archived versions of Science Friday in real audio or take them with you on your audible.com player. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.